Made famous by Hollywood, this small-town sheriff supposedly took up his post to fight crime. After decades of myth-making, the truth behind his many exploits paints a much different picture than what the movie sold us. This week's episode is The Murder of Pauline Pusser and the Truth About Buford, Part 1.
A bump in the night, your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed, you'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Hood.
I'm gonna kill you.
Did you ever hear this guy before this?
Well, I've heard of this movie, but I honestly, I haven't watched it yet. I'm waiting to watch the Rock version. I did not really know the story behind it, though, and that it was based on a true story. And now a bunch of new information's come out. And it's wild that, man, sometimes like 30, 40 years can go by and everybody just believes this narrative that this person's a hero. And then we're seeing it a lot lately.
I was wondering.
And then the truth comes out and you're like, this person was a fucking nut the whole time.
Right. It's like we were sold a version. And then when you read, oh, I don't know, his own daughter's biography of him, like what is the true truth that doesn't even really get maybe sane washed for all the rest of us, you start going, oh, this person was like kind of a menace. Yeah. And the question as you all listen is like, was he an outlier of a menace and we just happened to hear about him? Or was this kind of stuff like probably going on a lot and we didn't have forensic science and thoughtful district attorneys and stuff being like, we need probable cause for this.
No. And just vigilante justice of people, everybody having a gun. It was a long time ago. Especially if you're in law enforcement, you're kind of untouchable, or you just become feared like Rex McElroy and you're like, nobody will touch you.
Yeah, because you're 6'6" and 250 pounds. But I have heard of this story. I heard the movie. My parents went to go see it in the theaters. Like my dad loved kind of Dirty Harry movies and Western movies. So it was kind of up his alley. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine today who is from Tennessee, East Tennessee. And he said when Pusser died that it was brought up in their Sunday school class. And my friend was like, you know, I was in middle school and the Sunday school teacher was like, he was my cousin. And, you know, he was a great hero of a man. It's one of those where I think too, coming from a place like a small town, everybody tries to have a piece of him. And because of that, your ego becomes inextricably linked with the image of this person. So what an image it is though.
And then when the image changes, you got to decide, are you going to continue supporting this person or admit we were all duped? And that's a question everyone can ask themselves right now as things come to light.
As there's
as files are released.
A historic 472-1 vote to release the files. Everyone's like, that one guy, what are you doing, Clay Higgins?
I hope he goes home today.
It's like,
and his wife is just like, what the fuck, babe, is wrong with you?
Babe,
what the fuck were you doing?
Good Lord. Like,
one and he shamed into being in a public apology because
he posted.
I mean, you never want to be the one vote unless it's like, and I vote for free healthcare for all. When it's, no, I think we should protect the pedophiles and you're the one vote. Maybe we should start looking into why that is, sir.
On his social media, in part, he said, I think that this widespread disclosure is going to get a lot of innocent people in trouble. I was like, oh, no.
Oh, perhaps like, you guys you're on that list.
You're going to be reading things wrong, you guys. It's gonna, I don't know.
You're going to see my name on there, but we spell it differently, and it's not the same guy, okay?
Was that on The Office where it's like, I can figure out the rat by asking, what do you think I should do to the person when I find out who they were? And this guy's like, if they're on the list, be nice to them. Maybe just forgive them. And you're like, I think you're on the list.
It's what is the biblical tale of cutting the child in half?
Dude, Solomon.
Yeah, Solomon. Yeah, it's like that. There you go.
Well, I'm excited to get into old Pusser lore today.
God, And we just got to get it out of the way up top. His name is Pusser.
Yeah. So there.
And there's that.
And his family's
names. And his family's names.
All kinds of Pussers.
Especially the daughter. If your last name was Pusser, you cannot name your daughter Dawana.
You know.
Dawana Pusser?
You know. Bless her
heart. We can't do that.
She was a strong woman her whole life. They're like, we're going to give her a name so that she's going to have to carry around a stick and beat kids that make fun of her. It's like, done.
Her middle name was like Adiata or so. It pronounced, no, it's even like, it added even more to it. When it's, you put it all together, it's a lot.
Small town, Tennessee folks.
You know, you can't help your last name. Mm-mm. You can help what you name your kid when you know what your last name is.
It's true. You do have that power as a parent.
You have that power.
Some people wield it incorrectly, I would say.
With great power comes great responsibility. And Buford really leaned into that a mm-hmm. lot, for good or for bad, or maybe both, maybe just bad.
Yeah, maybe that's just how he was brought up.
Well, I'm Christy.
I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. Buford Hayes Pusser was born on December 12, 1937, in the tiny community of Finger, Tennessee, an unincorporated town with fewer than 500 residents. His parents, Carl and Helen Pusser, were steady fixtures of small-town life. Carl later served as police chief of nearby Adamsville. Even as a boy, Buford towered over his classmates, eventually growing to 6'6" and more than 250 pounds. He played basketball and football, excelling through sheer size, strength, and discipline.
He was the youngest of three, and his brother's name was John Howard, and his sister's name was Galia Pusser. So they were just going. They were like, they went from John Howard to Galia to Buford. So maybe
to Dawana and his for his children,
his daughter. Yeah. I mean, they grew up on a farm. So I think Finger is like less than 500 people. I mean, back then, even smaller. And then Adamsville, Dawana says in her book, was like 1,000 people. So they went from like ultra small town to what they felt like was city life. Mm-hmm. Like they were city folks.
And we're all just going to get through it. I'm talking to myself mostly of. They lived in Finger, Tennessee, and their last name was Pusser. Because I'm really fighting for my life to read some of these sentences.
They're like, are you the Adamsville Pussers or the Finger Pussers? Like, we're the Finger Pussers.
We're the Finger
okay.
Pussers.
Finger Pussers, I've heard good things about the Finger Pussers. You got nice, warm, welcoming people, the Finger Pussers. They're like, absolutely. Oh. But for funsies, I mean, it's crazy to read her book because she kind of dials into her dad's childhood, and then she'll be like, one time grandpa was in the outhouse taking a dump, and dad, in not so many words, and she's like, and daddy thought it'd be real funny to mess with him, so he shot a shotgun through the side of the outhouse, and grandpa came running out with his drawers down, and you're like, so, okay, that's one way to do a prank. It's just
some
like,
might say attempted murder, you know, if that had gone wrong. We got involuntary manslaughter.
And then she was like, yeah, and then a bunch of kids were crazy, and they drive by daddy and yell at him and his friends. And Buford cut his leg, taking a volleyball net down, and then went to his friends and goes, hey, that gang of guys that just drove past us, look what they did. They cut me in the leg. And the friends are like, we got to get him. So Buford gets his dad's shotgun. They drive to the other town. They lie to his mom and say they're going to go squirrel hunting. But really, they go, Buford shot into the window of these people's car. At the risk of sounding like Ferris Bueller, 9 times. He shot a shotgun into another teenager's car 9 times.
That did nothing wrong.
No, I mean, they were like in a rivalry.
His ego was hurt and he was embarrassed. He cut his leg, taking down a volleyball net, and decided to go take it out on some people that had nothing to do with it.
And his
nine times.
And his daughter's the one that ratted him because she wrote it all in the book and was like, well, dad told everybody it was the guys, but he lied. I'm like, what is everyone just pulling this gun out? But he was a huge kid. He got a job at like a general store, and there's a picture of him with like the other employees. And by the time he was like a teen, I mean, he's like a full head taller than the grownups in the picture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if he's like, give me that shotgun, you're not going to be like, no, Buford.
No, and everyone had one back then. It was... I mean, squirrel hunting mm-hmm. probably started around, you know, you're in your single digits, maybe just turned 10 type of thing. So people are handling shotguns from a very early age, and they kind of unfortunately become like toys then. The like significance and weight of what they can do kind of it gets muddied when you start playing around with them at such a young age.
That's a really good point, because his mom was scared because they moved to Adamsville, and her husband was, before he became the police chief, he went off and worked at the oil rigs in Oklahoma. So he, you know, it was mom home alone with the kids, and she heard a weird sound at the door. So she went and looked, and there was no one out there. And then she heard the weird sound again. So she shot a shotgun through the door. And then the
next
morning, not knowing
what she's shooting at all.
And sadly, there was a cat on the other side of it. So it's like her first inclination was like, well, fuck it, there's a sound.
Yeah.
Just shot out the door.
What if it was a kid, you know?
A neighbor, yeah. A police officer, a kid. Your husband coming home because, like, the oil rig sent me home early. Yeah. But you're right. I think that becomes so prevalent that you're like, oh, well, if there's just a sound, mom just shoots out the door. So it'll be fun to go shoot grandpa while he's taking a dump.
It just becomes a kind of a nothing thing, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone's like, yeah, whatever. We have a gun. We shoot it all the time. That's one way to grow up.
Yeah.
After high school, Buford enlisted in the Marine Corps, but his military career was short-lived. During recruit training, he was medically discharged for asthma attacks after serving just a few weeks. He later claimed he
spent months
in the service, and was discharged with a broken back due to a car crash. The crash happened after his asthma discharge, however, and official records contradict Pusser's version of events.
That's the other thing is, like, well, first he was, like, going to work on the oil rigs with his dad, and then was like, I don't want to, I think he got a football scholarship to Florida University, was like, I'm done with football, I want to be in the Marines. So to hear him tell it in an interview later, he was like, well, I was really excited about being a Marine, but I got in this car accident and I got medically discharged. But his own daughter was like, he was 3 of his 6 weeks he was a Marine, he was in the hospital because of asthma.
Yeah, so, I imagine if you've got asthma, boot camp is not for you.
No, and he even tried to get put in a place that was further north because he thought that that would hide his asthma, but they don't really like take into consideration your request. So he was sent to South Carolina in the summer, and I guess that made it, I don't know, made him overheated.
Humidity
worse.
And all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just another example of not being truthful when he perceives it makes him look weak.
Yes. Yes.
He makes a story up that I think in his opinion is more accepted, or he looks more heroic, when it's like, there's no shame in, like, you had asthma and you had to leave the military, but, or there's no shame in you cut your leg on a volleyball net, but, like, everything was a personal attack against him, even when he created it himself, and he just, like, had to go take it out on others.
Yeah, it's like an ego protection. And she said, when he was honorably discharged for the asthma thing, he wore his uniform all the way home. She said he wore it, like, literally till the last minute he was allowed to still, you know, I guess you're not supposed to wear your uniform, like, once you're out. But there's something to that, like, obsession with appearing a certain way.
Yeah.
And even in her book, she says, you know, Daddy and his friends would go to at the time, post-World War II, there was this influx of crime in Adamsville, right on the line between Tennessee and Mississippi, because liquor was still outlawed there. So there was kind of this moonshine opportunity. And then she kind of goes, Daddy and his friends would just go to these gambling joints, go to these beer joints, go to these brothels. And she's like, you know, they just would hang around and gawk like schoolboys do. And you're like, I don't think that's what they were doing. But again, it's just this, I'm going to write this book to uphold my dad's image, his legacy. And so you could just admit, I mean, he was an 18-year-old guy, and you live within spitting distance of, like, a moonshine place, and the women are easy, and you get to go throw dice. It's not unreasonable.
I'd be there.
Yeah, but it's, like, crazy that she's like, well, he just went to go look and just watch the dice games. Like, I don't think he was.
It's kind of that thing we've talked about before with adult children and their parents who have passed, and, like, what memories do you want to believe about them, or kind of what is the story you want to keep alive.
Yeah.
Not all of us write books. But she seems to have a certain image she wants to uphold of her dad.
Mm-hmm. Sinisterhood will be right back. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. As the days get shorter, it's easy to start feeling a little off, but a simple check-in with someone you care about can make a big difference, even if it's just a quick message or a call.
The darker months can be tough, and it's something a lot of people quietly struggle with. That's why this time of year, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to reach out. Whether it's a friend, a loved one, or someone you haven't heard from in a while, a little connection goes a long way.
And just like texting a friend takes a little bit of effort, reaching out to therapy can feel like a big step. But once you do it, it often brings real relief. A lot of people come away from their first session thinking, why didn't I do this sooner?
BetterHelp has helped over 5 million people find licensed therapists who listen and support real progress. They make it easy to get started by matching you with the therapist based on your needs and preferences, so you can focus on your goals, not the guesswork. And if the fit isn't right, you can switch anytime.
I love starting my Mondays off with meeting with my BetterHelp therapist. It really is a time for me to ask myself, like, what have I been, you know, struggling with this past week? How do I want to set myself up for the rest of this week? And things like, I'm just feeling down right now. And having a third party to be able to help me talk out why I might be feeling down, whether it is the weather change, whether, you know, whatever it might be, is so valuable. And I can't imagine starting my Mondays without it.
Love it. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step.
Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/sinister. That's betterhelp.com/sinister.
At 18 years old and with no other prospects, Buford packed up and moved to Chicago in 1957. There, he pursued a semi-professional wrestling career under the name Buford the Bull. His size was noticeable and helped form the early parts of his personal legend. One tale alleged that Buford even wrestled an actual bear and won.
Well, it's one of those where everybody's like, he wrestled a grizzly bear. He wrestled a grizzly bear. His daughter claims that whenever he was a teen, a man came through with a carnival and had a small bear that was actually a black bear, not a grizzly bear, that was maybe didn't have teeth and maybe didn't have claws.
Well, I can fight that.
And yes, and he said, okay, I pinned the bear. And that got turned into, that guy was a wrestler. And also one time he wrestled a bear. And then it got turned into, he wrestled a grizzly bear. And everyone saw it and he beat the bear. And it's like, there's probably plenty of people who are like, I was there. I was there when Buford the Bull fought the bear. And they're full of shit.
it's how tall tales get started. It's interesting, though, to see kind of the origin of how something like that would. Also, fuck circuses that are taking bears with no teeth and claws around and letting people pin them to the ground.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're charging tickets too. It's like exploitation, everything. But, back in the, I guess that would have been the 50s. But yeah, he ended up in Chicago because there was just no, I mean, it was go work on the oil rig with your dad. The dad was started to get older and was going to move back to Adamsville. That's when dad became the police chief. And you're just like, a guy at the oil rig's like, Chicago's cool. And you're like, I can make some money in Chicago. He also kept trying to be a mortician everywhere he went. He would like take jobs, which again, it has to do with appearance. I don't know, making people look good.
Interesting. I was thinking of a close connection to death and burial.
True. Control with them after they died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or a way to dispose of without fingers being pointed.
That's true. You would have pretty good insight onto decomposition of bodies and how long things would start to go bad and how much time one would have if one was trying to dispose of a body. Didn't think of that when he was like, I think I want to go to mortuary school. I think I want to learn that.
In Chicago, he met Pauline Mullins, a young divorcee with two children. Pauline's brother, Griffin, called her
the leader of our family and the most caring, personable person that you would ever want to meet.
Pauline had a warm steadiness that balanced Buford's restless ambition. They married on December 5th, 1959, when Buford was just 22. He took a job at a paper bag manufacturing company to support the family. And before long, they welcomed a daughter, Dwana Pusser, in 1961.
Dwana Pusser enters the chat.
Yeah, she's here.
She has entered the chat.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, and that's what her name is, and we'll just move on. The couple returned to Adamsville around 1960, moving back into the orbit of his parents. Buford joined his father on the Adamsville police force before working his way up to replace his dad as chief. By his own later telling, violence found him early. Buford claimed in a filmed interview that sometime between 1962 and 1964,
I was beaten and robbed on the state line and the local law enforcement wasn't doing anything about it. That's when I decided to run for sheriff. But this is true. He was down gambling. He was up like $300, and he said that suddenly, this was before he moved to Chicago. So he has this like, I guess it was while he came home visiting while he was in Chicago. So he's got this grudge that he's been holding for multiple years. And he says, okay, I went down there. I was in the middle of a dice game. They changed the dice on me in the middle of it. And when I called them out, they drug me out back and they beat the shit out of me and threw me in the cold, which is the same story his daughter told. So then he marries Pauline on December 5th, 1959. On December 13th, 1959, so like 8 days later, he went back to that establishment and beat the shit out of the people at that establishment. Quite nearly, I mean, got charged eventually and then the charges were dropped. But it was interesting that he then, again, his daughter wrote this all as how it happened. But at the time of running for sheriff, he had sort of wrapped himself up in this, I'm this poor victim and this horrible thing happened to me, when in the first place, he was in an illegal gambling place.
Yeah.
And then he returned because he was mad that the gambling place stole all of his money. And
which is a crime in itself, yes, the gambling part, also the stealing, but also the going back and beating the shit out of him. So he's like, it's against the law, but not for me. I'm doing a heroic act.
It's this question of like, well, but it's righteous and these are evildoers. And so you start to get these very like good and bad lines, even though they don't really track where we societally would track them. It's like this frontier justice almost, which is crazy because it's the 50s. And also that you just like roll into town and they're like, your dad was police chief. You can be police chief now too.
Nepotism at its finest, especially in a small town in the South.
Oh, yeah. Sure, for sure.
You didn't have to work too hard to get that position.
No, and I think you realize that a police chief can do a little bit, but a sheriff has the whole county. And the sheriff, I'm not saying Pusser's dad was taking bribes or Pusser was taking bribes, but one has to wonder, in a very bribable area,
If the Pusser was getting into some, the Pusser was fingering the wrong guys.
If the Pusser fits.
If it walks like a pusser, talks like a pusser,
beats stick like a pusser, it's a pusser.
In August of 1964, at only 27, Buford ran for sheriff of McNairy County against the incumbent, James Dickey. Buford alleged Dickey was involved in illegal moonshine operations in cahoots with the very criminals that had beaten and robbed him at the border. Buford won out over Dickey, who had died in a car accident just 5 days before the election. He was the youngest sheriff elected in Tennessee history. And only because the incumbent died in a car crash, which, I mean.
Yeah, R.I.P. Dickey.
do we know much about how that happened?
Yeah, it was just an oopsie accident. I'm sorry, Dickey. I'm sorry for what happened. Although it does seem like the criminals of the area were willing to kill people, including law enforcement, and probably, you know, if you are a complicit sheriff and you start to want more money or you start to not be complicit or whatever, I mean, they take you out easily. Yeah. But you got a 27-year-old now in charge of your
There's
county.
More of them than there are of you.
Truly.
Buford's enforcement style was intense, personal, and at times uniquely physical. He became known for carrying a large homemade club and directly confronting criminals, earning a reputation as
a hard-nosed, no-nonsense law officer.
During his first year, he raided 42 stills and arrested 75 moonshiners, an enormous number for a rural Tennessee county, reflecting his unusually proactive approach to dismantling illegal operations. His actions were so significant that the Tennessee General Assembly formally recognized him in 1969, naming him an honorary sergeant-at-arms for his accomplishments.
I just can't imagine that all of the searches that he conducted, that he obtained a warrant for.
No!
Like, there's just no way that he
it's
was like...
It's hard for me to imagine that, like, even the majority of the things he carried out were legal. Or in good faith.
No.
To, you know, like not just a vendetta.
He had a huge vendetta against, we'll speak briefly in a minute about Louise Hathcock, but there was another higher up in the so-called state line mob that was named Toehead White. And Towhead White was
Towhead
another.
Towhead White is redundant.
Come on now. It's like, what other kind of white is there? But Towhead White had issues with Pusser. And of course, you go in, you take down 45 stills, you take down 75 criminals. They started getting threats against the family. And he had made his daughter part of his sheriff campaign. Like, there were little pictures of Dawana, like a baby that was like, Dawana says, vote for my daddy for sheriff kind of thing. So they know he's got a family. It's also a small town. So they start getting threatening phone calls, you know, once he's really cracking down. What do you do when you get threatening phone calls? Well, if you're Buford Pusser, he just went to the Shamrock Motel where Towhead White was hanging out, found him, grabbed him. He said, get in the car with me. He took him down to a swamp, just the two of them. He handcuffed Towhead White, made him get out of the car, crawl around in the swamp, handcuffed, begging for his life. Quote, this went on for most of the night. Then daddy said to him, I'm telling you, Towhead, I know you're behind this. If you call my wife or my daddy and threaten either of them or my children, I promise I'll be back to get you and we'll be back here if I get one more phone call. And then she just wrote, the phone call stopped. And you're like,
I bet they did.
Lady, yes, he's a criminal. But like, what do we want a sheriff who just no arrest warrant, no problem? I mean, you falsely imprisoned this man.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of... We talked on our last episode briefly about that Dads Against Predators thing,
oh, yeah.
Which I want to go on record saying I'm not in favor of that, which I think maybe it got misconstrued on that episode that we like support that.
No.
You know, vigilante justice. It can go one of two ways, and I think more often than not, it goes into a very slippery slope, dangerous territory where you get a reputation, but also you you just think you're above the law. And when you are the law and you're also a vigilante, then that's just like all angles are covered with, I can do whatever the fuck I want.
You really do get this empowered monster because on the one hand, he had no law enforcement background, like no training, essentially was kind of pointed at and been like, you're Carl's kid, you're next. We've decided. Mm-hmm. Even like the Historical Society of McNary County was like, the town council voted and they picked Buford to be in charge. So when you have somebody like
Or were they encouraged to do
with
so?
With a big stick. This guy with a big fucking stick that knocked a bear down. He wants that job now. And you're like, okay, I guess he gets the job. But there's just story after story of the response that Buford had was like, take the licking and keep on ticking. Like, basically, you can hit me. It doesn't matter. Almost Michael Myers-esque, which it's funny that it was turned based upon a vacuum. There was a lack of other law enforcement. These people felt unsafe. So for them, this guy was a hero, right? It's the Batman issue, right? Gotham City's detective force is ineffectual. And so you want this vigilante. The problem is, I think you're right, when they are vigilantes, as it was the case of Dads Against Predators, sometimes it's the wrong person. Not always, but sometimes. And the problem becomes, in this case, it's the right person, but that's not what you should do to even the right person, because even the correct suspect deserves everything we would want. We don't want to empower this dude to just go, I can just go torture someone in a swamp all night and literally no one will ever know and I'll never get in trouble for it, because then it sort of leads to escalations.
And at this point, he's already the sheriff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So he could have just taken him. He could have taken Towhead down to the county jail, handled it the proper way. But he has this swamp life authority that he's just like, this is how we do it out in the swamp. And so when you can't count on even the sheriff to do things legally, then the whole card of houses comes down. The whole house of cards comes down pretty quick.
No, for real though, and especially a person who has no oversight. Like, at no point did I see. And then the DA told him, hey, we've gotten some complaints about you, Buford. It was like this small, if I hate to say this, but like kind of forgotten area. And McNary County was especially susceptible to crime because it was one of the dry counties in Tennessee and it was right on the border. So it kind of just whenever a place called, I think it was Phoenix City, Alabama, she was writing about it in her book, but essentially there was a big crackdown somewhere a little bit further south. And so the criminals had to go somewhere and they were mm-hmm. like, what's a market? Oh, look, for whatever reason in the 50s, alcohol is illegal in this county. That's a place we can make money, moonshining. And for sure. there's a bunch of economically disadvantaged people that might be willing to take up a gig at a brothel, roadhouse, moonshine place. So I think it's like anything we talk about, a snake's gonna bite. Like criminals saw like this is an opportunity, and from his perspective he's like, this is an opportunity, I can beat the shit out of people and no one will say anything.
Mm-hmm. And kind of not just swing that club around, but his dick, he's just yeah. like, I'm the sheriff in town, nobody fucks with me, nobody fucks with my family, I'll do whatever I want to you.
No, and it makes sense because his daughter wrote, oh, dad got bullied in school, which I don't really know how, if he was like humongous and also played basketball and football and stuff. But she said, oh, he got bullied in school. And so he always kind of knew what it was like to be the underdog. And I'm like, or you got bullied in school and then suddenly because you chugged down a bunch of milk, his words, not mine, you become 6'6 and 250 pounds. And you're like, who's the bully now, bitch? Like, yeah. If he really was bullied as a kid, when he grew large enough to take the power back, it's like, now it's power that's wielded for maybe a little bit vengeance purposes, yeah. given the fact yeah. that 8 days after his wedding, he just fucking drove down to beat the shit out of a guy that stole $300 from him, like, years before.
Or you just write the narrative you want. You tell mm-hmm. your kids the stories that make you look heroic and like you have a justification for behaving the way you do. Mm-hmm. And it didn't even happen at all.
True. Damn.
It's hard to know.
Sinisterhood, we'll be right back.
Bad habits can lead to bad outcomes, but it doesn't have to be that way. Fume is here to help with a smarter alternative. It's a flavored air device, not a vape, not a pipe, but something completely different.
Fume lets you satisfy the urge to reach for something without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. Plus, it comes with amazing flavors like crisp mint, spearmint ice, orange vanilla, and mango to keep things fresh. Man, I'll tell you what, I like the minty one, and I really particularly love holding it in my hand, and I won't lie, I like chewing on it.
It's got that little rubber tip to chew on. It's got the fidgets for your fingers. It's mm-hmm. a good thing if you've got like oral fixation, just sensory things. You want to be able to like fidget and do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the bases covered. Like to keep yours in the car.
Keep one, yeah, or my purse. Yeah, mm-hmm. I like to just slip it down in a backpack, perhaps when I'm traveling. That's the magic of a fume. It goes Absolutely. Anywhere, baby.
Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits. And now it's your turn. Use our code CREEPY to get a free gift with your journey pack.
Head to TryFume, that's TryFume.com. Use code CREEPY to claim this limited time offer today.
Throughout the next few years, Buford launched highly publicized raids on gambling operations, more moonshine stills, prostitution rings, and roadhouses along the Tennessee-Mississippi border. He portrayed himself as the lone force standing against a shadowy network known as the State Line Mob, a term for the criminals operating across two adjacent counties on either side of the state line. He also claimed a battle with the Dixie Mafia, a loosely affiliated network of criminals operating across southern states at that time. Among his many confrontations, at least two people died at Sheriff Pusser's hands. The most widely documented on-the-job killing occurred on February 1st, 1966, at the Shamrock Motel, a roadhouse on the Tennessee-Mississippi line, long associated with the State Line Mob. According to Buford, he went to the motel to investigate a complaint of theft in illegal liquor sales. Inside, he confronted the proprietor, Louise Hathcock, a woman with deep ties to the shadow economy of the region. Buford maintained that Hathcock pulled a .38 caliber handgun from her purse and fired first, narrowly missing him, forcing him to return fire.
The story that Duana tells is that some Yankees from Illinois were stopped.
Of course, she's got to call them Yankees.
They were stopped at the motel and they said that they had some items, goods, cash stolen from their room that was worth about $500. And Louise's husband, who was another, you know, criminal, mafioso, whatever you want to call him, had been killed a little bit before that. And it was kind of suspected that Louise did it. It was subsequently also put forth that maybe Towhead White did it. But things were heating up to the point that there was inter-mafia murders happening, and also I think just Buford's gonna come in and shut us down, so we better go hard and like fuck it, do whatever we can. So he I think he came in ready to crack skulls. It was him and his deputy, whose name was Petey Plunk.
What is happening? What is happening in Tennessee in the 1950s and 60s?
Yeah.
I mean, lot was happening. I get that. Plunk. But these, I don't know.
Pusser and Plunk.
I wonder if he Pusser went in. Plunk. What'd you say?
I said Pusser and Plunk.
I wonder if he went in and that even happened. You know, maybe she reaches for something. He thinks it's a gun. Maybe she didn't reach for anything. And he just, because you can't trust the story that he comes back with. No one is there as a witness. So he kills the person that the only other person that was there. And then it's just like, well, this is the story and nobody can argue with it.
You're right. It's interesting that they go into the lobby and it's the other deputy's name was Jim Moffitt. So it's like Jim and Petey and Buford are in the lobby. And then Dawana's like, Louise Hathcock comes out a bit disheveled in her stretch pants, which, okay. Who amongst us hasn't been? and apparently Louise said, "You damn punk, I'm not going anywhere." And that's when Pusser was like, "We need to talk." Allegedly, Louise said, "Come back here. I want to talk to you in private. I'll tell you exactly what's been going on." She led Daddy behind the front desk to her apartment, known as Number One Cabin. And that's apparently where her husband, Jack, had been killed as well. And they are back in this room. And I think that's a really good point that the story is that Louise lured him into a back room. But what might really have happened is like, hey, let's me and you go talk. And that's when things happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, he allegedly he was asked by her to come into her room and that she asked him to close the door and that she had tried to shoot him. But due to being drunk from the night before, she missed.
That's a lot of she did things when nobody knows. And a lot of holes in the story. If she was like, "You damn punk, I'm not going anywhere. Come back to my room, just the two of us, and shut the door." Like, those two things wouldn't, you know? If you're like, "I'm not going anywhere," you're not then going to invite the person you think is going to be taking you somewhere to be alone with you in your room. You know?
It was interesting, too, that she doesn't say, "And my dad was an idiot and followed this known criminal away from his backup into a room that she had access to." But I think you're right that the story is going to get twisted in a way that every single time Buford Pusser is going to be like Uncle Jimbo on South Park and just be like, "It was coming right for us."
Yeah.
Like every time. Exactly. She was coming right for me.
But autopsy details and later historical accounts point out a troubling fact. Hathcock was shot twice in the back, an angle inconsistent with someone facing and shooting at an officer. Despite the discrepancy, the shooting was ruled self-defense and closed without further inquiry. This incident became one of the early pillars of Buford's vigilante mystique. He framed himself as a fearless sheriff taking down a dangerous mob figure. However, the evidence planted seeds of skepticism among locals who questioned how a woman could be shot in the back during a head-on confrontation.
And there was much to do about that he had killed a woman, and the facts that came out in the public were that she was found with a revolver clasped in her hands. Like, this was a crazy lady that was trying to kill him, because his daughter made much about, like, growing up, Daddy had a lot of friends that were girls. Like, he was just loved by girls. He would never want to kill a woman.
She loves her daddy, and she's not going to speak a bad word about
him. Never would have breathed a word. But it's like, even in trying to uphold this narrative, you still have to put forth that he was alone in the room with her and went with her alone in the room and alleges, you know, that these two shots in her back were necessary. But
yeah, the back is, you know, that's just science. You can't be standing to somebody pulling a gun out and then get shot in the back too. Those two things can't happen.
No.
By early 1967, the mythology of a tough-on-crime sheriff obscured what acquaintances later described as turmoil at home. Multiple people recalled that Pauline had been planning to leave Buford. Her brother, Griffin Mullins, said in a later interview,
Pauline didn't tell me a whole lot. She was just not the type of person to tell you her problems. But I knew deep down there were problems in her marriage.
She had allegedly taken to smuggling her own clothes out of the house, wearing multiple outfits so she could remove some without drawing her husband's attention. Her reasons were not recorded in any formal statements, but those who knew her said she seemed increasingly unhappy. Well, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to, you know, draw the conclusion that he was probably pretty violent at home and he liked to drink a lot. And we know he liked to shoot guns and beat the shit out of people. Why would that stop with his wife wearing clothes out of the house, like, you know, taking stuff in secrecy to not alert him to anything? All speaks to domestic violence and her trying to leave.
Yeah. And just sort of the idea that if he finds out that you're leaving, it's going to worse, that you have to obscure that. So interesting that given that relationship dynamic, what happens next and how it's all spun.
In the early hours of August 12, 1967, Buford later claimed his phone rang around 4 a.m. He said it was a report of a disturbance near New Hope Methodist Church, a small site on the rural outskirts of Adamsville. He said Pauline insisted on riding with him that morning. No official record of such a call has ever been found. The only source was Buford himself. According to his account, they drove toward the church in near darkness. Sometime between 4:15 and 4:30 a.m., a car pulled alongside theirs. Muzzle flashes lit up the windows. Pauline was struck in the head. Buford was struck in the jaw. He told investigators later that he spun the wheel, gave chase at nearly 100 miles an hour, and was fired on a second time.
Yeah, he said a Cadillac pulled up beside them and that somebody with a 30 carbine rifle shot into their car. Buford was carrying a 41 Magnum at the time, so kind of a handgun, and said that the first shot hit Pauline in the head. She fell over into Buford's lap. This is the story that Buford told, and that the men in the Cadillac kept firing on them. And that's when, you know, he got shot and that he was pulled over eventually and tried to see what he could do to help Pauline because he was away now from the killers. He got on the mic, radioed for help on the county sheriff's frequency. And in fact, Buford's dad, Papa, heard the call come through on the radio, which has got to be a really tough call to get.
Oh, yeah. It would be a tough call at 4 a.m. to get. And then your wife's like, I'm going with you.
Yeah.
That's also trying to leave you. I don't buy that.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Dwana said in the book that mother wanted to go with him and said, oh, if you take me with you, you can buy me breakfast on the way back. Let me get dressed and I'll go with you at 3 o'clock in the morning to go check out a disturbance.
Convenient excuse for sure for why strange. She was there.
Definitely strange.
Around 4:40 to 5 a.m., responders and locals began arriving. Among them was 16-year-old Dennis Hathcock, who had been driving the area and stumbled upon the chaos. Years later, he recalled seeing part of Pauline's scalp on the pavement.
Blonde hair strung out and brain matter.
Along the roadside. It was an image that stayed with him for the rest of his life. Pauline was pronounced dead at the scene. Buford, bleeding heavily from the jaw, was taken for emergency surgery.
And I will say, it is fairly convenient that his jaw was hit because he was really unable to speak. They said even on the mic to radio for help, he was basically just saying, like, help, state line, 45, like trying to get a little bit of info out. So if you had needed some time to describe what had happened, having a jaw injury is very convenient because you have a lot of time to go, like, I would talk, but I can't. My jaw, I have to have surgery. Sorry.
And I just lost my wife.
I'm so sad.
I'm grieving. Was Dennis Hathcock the son of Louise Hathcock?
Everybody was related. So he was somewhat related. I don't know that he was directly their son, but given a town of 1,000 people, a lot of people had the last name Hathcock. There were Pussers. There were cousins that were married into families. And so I think
Cox and the Pussers were just running that town.
And I believe Dennis Hathcock even said, like, oh, yeah, like, Buford shut down one of my family's moonshine stills, but like we had like 25 other ones. So whatever, you know, like, yeah, it was kind of a, I won't say playful because obviously he took people like Towhead out to the swamp or straight up shot Louise. But I think there was a cat and mouse kind of element to it. Mm. And my own speculation, I don't think Buford was as clean as everybody says he was.
Right.
So I think he was, you know, playing one side against the other. So yeah. People
getting
speak
paid off by the stills for sure.
Somebody. Sinister Hood will be right back. Let's just let everybody know in advance. I love the goose. I love Buffy. I love the goose. I'm a dog person. I'm like an annoying dog lady. You sent me a picture of yourself holding the goose earlier. And I was like, my baby. Look at her. Also, the goose looks cute too. I'm just kidding. But seriously, I was like, look at you guys together.
They are sweet. They deserve the best. And that is why we got to switch to Ollie. We switched to Ollie. They offer fresh, protein-packed meals made with real human-grade ingredients, which is a win for the goose, Buff's, Kate's health, and they offer 5 tasty recipes, all slow-cooked for top nutrition, which is a win for all of our dogs' happiness.
Ollie makes mealtime easy and exciting for you and your dog. Their food is human grade, so if the grid goes down, you could theoretically eat it. It's vet formulated and seriously tasty. Even picky pups get excited. Each meal is tailored to your dog's needs and comes in perfectly portioned, no mess packs. Plus, they include, that handy scoop and the pup-tainer for your fridge. Mm-hmm. It keeps it all so fresh. The app even offers real-time health support and uses data from other dogs to keep improving. So it's smart, it's clean, and made to actually make your life easier. Man, that pup-tainer or something else.
I love it. I'll tell you right now, and this isn't hyperbole, Ollie spends more time making dog food than I spend making my own kids' food. Like they are more health conscious and like on top of it. In fact, maybe I should just start giving Ella and Simon some of these because I'm not making lamb and blueberries. I'll tell you that. But
no, slow
Ollie's
roasted.
Got it on lock and if the grid goes down, we're going to be okay over here.
Don't worry about it. Your dog's well-being starts with their food, and that's why Ollie delivers fresh, human-grade food that your dog will love. Head to ollie.com/creepy, tell them all about your dog, and use code creepy to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today.
Plus, they offer a happiness guarantee on the first box, so if you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back. That's OLLIE.com/creepy and enter code creepy to get 60% off your first box. Within days, the official story was announced. The Dixie Mafia had attempted to assassinate Sheriff Pusser and killed his wife in the crossfire. The narrative spread quickly. Locals sympathetic to him accepted it at face value. Others whispered suspicions as early as late August and September of that year, claiming that the story did not add up. But in 1967, no evidence was collected that might have contradicted Buford's version. No autopsy was performed on Pauline, no forensic reconstruction was attempted, and no charges were filed against any Dixie Mafia members.
And that was what stood out to me, that Buford would say to people that asked, like, oh, it was Towhead, or oh, it was so-and-so, it was probably this, it was because of this reason. There was another guy whose last name was Nix, I think. And again, okay, if that's true, and they really did kill your wife, I feel like the type of person who drove 8 days after his wedding and beat the fuck out of somebody for $300 would maybe actually, you know, would go, you know,
take
what, I don't care,
into his own hand.
Yeah, who cares? I'm just gonna go shoot the guy that did this. Yeah. I don't care. But instead, no,
or
it's
at
like,
the very least, arrest them. You're the sheriff. I mean, yes. An arrest could be made without you even having to like go kill him. Yeah. You could frame someone, but like not even that was done.
No, and also not even an autopsy to be like, okay, how many guns? What kind of guns was it? Mm-hmm. Oh, so and so always carries that type of weapon or whatever. It was more like, well, you know, bad things. I'm going to vote no on these files because whoever's in him might get their, you know, it might be bad for the person that's in him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Buford couldn't talk for a while. I mean, to plan the funeral, he had to use like sign language and stuff. Like he could, I mean, his jaw was significantly destroyed.
I think you make a very good point of like, well, one, if they're shooting through the car, it's got to hit somewhere, you know, it can't be like your leg because that wouldn't make sense. But also the jaw gives you a lot of time to not have to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a convenient aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. Buford underwent multiple reconstructive surgeries and a lengthy hospital stay. After the shooting, he wore his hair longer to cover the scars. He returned to work and continued running down the organized crime in his area. Another deadly on-the-job confrontation occurred on Christmas Day in 1968, when Buford responded to a call involving Charles Russell Hamilton, a man reportedly intoxicated and threatening his landlord with a gun. When Buford arrived on the scene, Hamilton allegedly fired at him, prompting the sheriff to return fire. Buford's bullet struck Hamilton between the eyes, killing him instantly.
It's another one of those he's coming right for us situations.
Yeah. And you just happen to have the perfect aim of right between the eyes is quite a shot.
Yeah. And again, the investigation is sort of like, yeah, it's all right. We know what happened.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. It's,
he told us.
He was drunk and threatened his landlord, so it's whatever. As with the Hathcock shooting, the death was declared self-defense and no grand jury was convened. The speed with which the shooting was cleared, paired with the lethal precision of the shot, added to Pusser's reputation as a man who routinely walked away from hailstorms of bullets and knife attacks. It also reinforced a pattern. Buford Pusser's use of deadly force was consistently accepted at face value by local authorities, even when the circumstances were murky.
I mean, and back to the killing of his wife, like the Tennessee governor at the time was like, we'll put out a $5,000 reward. And it was the version that Buford told them. That's what everyone believed. And he started telling people, I know who these the mafiosos who did this to my wife. I know who they are. And sort of implied that he had gone to Boston, to Texas, to Mississippi and tracked them down. And I took care of the problem. Don't worry about it. So the idea that he drove around to other states shooting the shooters wasn't too out of the realm of possibility because people straight watched him shoot Louise Hathcock and not get in trouble for it, shoot this guy and not get in trouble for it, because also they were quote unquote just crimes. So if he said, you know, don't worry about it, I'll give you a couple names, but I drove around and killed them all, people would believe him. And
yeah,
he's the only living witness.
Yeah, in every situation, isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
And this is much like speculation that he's taken stuff from the moonshiners. Who's he paying off on his own force? You know what I mean? You give somebody a couple jugs of moonshine or some cash to look the other way or to not ask questions, and everybody just goes on about their business.
Yeah, or you say, hey, if you tell anybody about this, I'll fucking kill you.
Yeah, I'll take you down to that swamp and have a fucking alligator eat you.
Yeah, it's like, okay, yeah, whatever you say, boss. Sounds good, boss.
In 1969, CBS News aired a segment about him in which correspondent Roger Mudd referred to Pusser as a
modern Wyatt Earp.
Suddenly, a local sheriff from rural Tennessee had become a national folk hero. Beyond the two formally documented deaths, Pusser's career was surrounded by persistent rumors of additional killings or violent confrontations that never made it into official records. During his tenure, he claimed to have been shot at 8 times, stabbed 7 times, and ambushed repeatedly by the state line mob.
Yeah, I would say he's probably like the most targeted person. Like
he's like Michael Myers, like you said, you just can't keep him down.
No, and when he talks about, I mean, early on in his career, I think he said they held him down and stabbed him like 30 times or so. I mean, he just got stabbed in one stabbing incident, sustained 30 stab wounds, kind of a thing, and with real knives and stuff. So,
and was that again, checked out by doctors? And was he got? Did he go to the hospital?
He also wrestled a bear, you know, it's like that. One of those things where it's like he was run over by a steamroller and survived. And you're, like, really?
Did he go to the hospital? No, they fixed it at home. It was a miracle.
No, he ain't a fucking pussy. He's a pusser. Pussies go to hospitals. Pussers, if you get run over by a steamroller, you just get over it, man.
You walk it off.
You fucking walk it off.
You're not some kind of pussy that needs surgery and medicine. You're a pusser.
Oh, they stitched your face up, pussy. Like, you should have let it heal on its own like a man. I'm a pusser man. Don't do Curtis Mayfield like that. But I will say, like, I think we're on to something joking around, but there is some sort of toxic masculinity element too.
Oh, 100%.
Like, yeah, you took the hit, so you're like a badass.
And also his refusal to admit anything other than the story that makes him look, in his opinion, like a badass.
Yeah. Yes. It's every one of them gets is justified. It's the
like
same
Paul
with
Bunyan.
Yes, it's the same with him going and beating the shit out of Towhead to get his $300 back. Mm-hmm. Is like, oh, I was taken for a ride, and it's like you were. There's no clean hands in any of these situations, no. But this desperate want to be exalted and like desperate need to be exalted, and the willingness of the community to be like, he is exalted. By mm-hmm. the way, he's our hero, and that enmeshment they have with his ego and or his image and their own like collective ego is crazy.
Yeah,
to watch.
His story, and like you said, wanting to kind of be a part of it, and. Mm-hmm. Tangentially related to a family that they thought was, you know, well-to-do, badasses, whatever. It's like the Hatfield and McCoy, you know, like mm-hmm. anybody that can be like kind of like in that circle. They're like, well, I'm protected now.
Yeah, and they want to have a piece of it too, because mm-hmm. like in the book, one of the teachers told a story like, oh, I'm the only teacher that ever whooped Buford Pusser. So then tells this whole story of like, when Buford was in my class, you know, this and this happened, and he got on my desk and he stood on my desk and caused a hole in my desk by standing on it.
Well, I mean, he was a big boy.
He was a big boy.
What and she's was like, that desk made up?
Right? And she's like, I drug him around and I whooped him with a paddle. And so was he in her class? Probably. Did that really happen, that his foot went through the desk, or did he knock stuff off the desk and then later on it mm-hmm. becomes the foot? So you just see that, truth be damned, like people just want, it's like they want the dopamine rush of the thrill of the story mm-hmm. and they don't really care about reality.
Yeah, no, it's a fantasy. A tall tale. Yeah.
Walking tall tale.
Ooh, very nice. In 1970, Buford crashed his car and was hospitalized for a month. Then in December of 1971, the Pusser family home burned down to the foundation, destroying everything inside. Officials attributed it to a dryer malfunction. For those who harbored doubts about Pauline's death, the loss of the home meant the loss of any physical evidence that might have been hidden there.
Yeah, the whole house just conveniently burned down. I don't think things were going super hot for him in 1970 because he was
not
ineligible.
Until that house burned down.
I mean, truly, that's extremely hot. But he was ineligible to run for re-election as a sheriff. So then he served as constable from 1970 to 1972 in Adamsville, which is not quite as good as sheriff, but I think he was a riding candidate. So he was kind of trying to, I feel like, find his place. And mm-hmm. I do think he was drinking a lot and also drunk driving, because he was just always getting into like horrible car crashes. And I'm like, you're either a fucking wretched driver or you're an impaired driver, or maybe both.
Yeah.
Could
someone
be both.
Someone who, if you're used to driving a car with a siren on it, you can go as fast as you want. You get behind your own car and it's like, I treat it the same.
Yeah. Fuck it, baby. Get out of my way. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Not long after, Hollywood came calling. The film, Walking Tall, was released in February of 1973 and retold Buford's story sensationally. It depicted him as a noble crusader who, armed with a giant wooden club, dismantled the Dixie Mafia while grieving the mob murder of his wife. The film was a smash success, grossing tens of millions of dollars. Any doubts about what happened to Pauline vanished, and the Hollywood version of the legend took hold, even if the real-life Pusser carried a club far less often than his silver screen portrayal.
It made $40 million on like a $500,000 budget.
73?
This is good. That huge. Was good money. I think people were like thirsty for it because Bing Crosby Productions, somebody like a rep from there saw the news story when he got called the modern Wyatt Earp, and I think very smartly was like, this makes for all the elements of a great tale. And then mm-hmm. you as the Hollywood producer aren't going to come in $500,000 budget. It wasn't even like a fancy Hollywood producer is not going to come in and go like, let's fact check this. Though.
Yeah.
The
yeah,
whole
yeah.
wife murder thing. So
and how do you even?
Right. Back then you mm-hmm. kind of go, he was there and he's the sheriff. That's the insidious thing too, I think, about having a person with a title have these tendencies, because that's a carte blanche to do all the things you want to
do. People with titles seem to get away with a lot of stuff.
You might be, you know, animal control. at a low level or up high to a sheriff at a higher level.
Or even the president of the United States.
Yeah, all the way up.
You can get away with a lot of stuff when you have a title in front of your name and you're a white man.
It always helps. Does help.
Every single time, in fact. Buford rubbed elbows with stars, striking up a friendship with Elvis and being photographed with Billy Graham and Johnny Cash. With the success of the film, Buford signed a contract with Bing Crosby Productions to portray himself in a sequel to Walking Tall. But he would never see a day on set. On August 21st, 1974, Buford died in a single vehicle crash on Highway 64. He had been at the county fair before heading out for a drive in his bright red, specially modified Corvette. Going an estimated 130 miles per hour, he lost control, struck an embankment, and was ejected from the vehicle. The car burst into flames.
Yeah.
Well, that'll do it.
Yeah. It's my understanding as well that Duana was in a car behind him. And so
yikes.
Drove up on that scene, but he, I feel like you get a little bit of money. You're already feeling like you're untouchable. Now you're famous. Like you're the fantasy that you've built up of yourself in your head has been made tangible, financially tangible too. And you're now going to get to play yourself in the movie. Like, I think that becomes success. You're hanging out with Johnny Cash. You're friends with Elvis. They started selling like pillowcases and bed sheets. Like, if it's big enough for Buford, it's big enough for you. Like, he started becoming like this more even of a celebrity than he was. And I don't know that he was like able to really handle that.
Yeah, it went to his head. And if you're already somebody that has a huge ego and thinks you're untouchable, I mean, this is only going to be add fuel to that fire. It's just a ticking time bomb until you do something like this. You drive 130 miles an hour and get ejected from your car because you think that you can do that. You've done it a million times before. You've killed multiple people and gotten away with it. So, I mean, you think you're, you know, walking on sunshine every single day. You can't be touched.
Yeah, I think you have this feeling of like, it'll be fine. It's always fine.
Mm-hmm.
Look what happened in 1967 in that ambush in the morning. It all worked out. It's all fine.
The state trooper on scene, Paul Irvin, later became sheriff of McNairy County and stated that Pusser's death resulted from drunk driving and not wearing a seatbelt. Some local speculation persisted about whether the crash was truly accidental, linking it to his many enemies, including an independently produced documentary called Buford Pusser, Another Side Told by Eddie Bond, but no official evidence supports sabotage.
I think Eddie Bond also later wrote a song about Buford, so I think he's very pro-pusser. He's a pro-puss.
He's a pusshead.
He's a pusshead, as it were. But he went around and interviewed people in the town. Duana, I believe, Mamaw, who is Buford's mother, they thought that it was shenanigans from the Dixie Line Mafia. I would say Occam's Razor, Corvette, 130 miles an hour.
No seatbelt, drunk.
Yes.
In a Corvette.
Yeah. But she, Duana said, I always had my doubts about the conclusion of him dying because of drunk driving. She said there were a lot of unanswered questions that the brief investigation never pursued. Pieces of the puzzle missing. But she said she got a document in the 90s that she's basically she got some paperwork that indicated there was money missing from his estate and or like some money got incorrectly spent or inappropriately spent. And maybe it was like loans to important people. And she kind of tried to use those to connect that it was truly a murder.
Yeah.
Which might be an easier pill to swallow than just like a tragic, like meaningless accident.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting that she points out there wasn't an investigation, and so we didn't find out anything. And that's been the story with all the criminal activity he's been involved in. It's like, well, there wasn't an investigation, so everybody just said, this is what happened. And now that very same thing is biting the family in the ass.
No, seriously. I mean, to her credit, she also was like, there was one thing we could all agree on. Daddy loved a fast car, and that's how he died. And it's like, he got in a car wreck when he was 18 coming out of the military, mm-hmm. when he was like,
yeah,
in the middle of his career. Like, I think he was just, they said when he borrowed his mom's car when he was a teenager, his friends would say, oh, when Buford would drive in town where someone could see and tell his dad or tell his mom, we would drive the speed limit. And they're like, we would get out on those roads, and he loved to go fast. So it's like,
you're lucky that
you're addicted to it.
Yeah, that you made it as long as you did, quite honestly.
And you didn't kill anybody in that situation, yeah. at least. Let's not mention all the people you killed before that.
Mm-hmm. After Buford's death, his legend grew far beyond the facts of his life. Between 1975 and 1977, Hollywood doubled down on the myth with Walking Tall Part 2, final chapter, Walking Tall, and a string of TV adaptations that recast the deceased sheriff as an indestructible lawman locked in perpetual battle with organized crime. Ballads were written about the sheriff, with Eddie Bond singing,
Buford Pusser was a Tennessee stallion, just one man against the whole battalion. They laid him down, but his legacy still lives on with you and me.
Throughout all his myth-making, Pauline was mentioned either briefly as a catalyst figure or not at all.
Yeah, it's kind of like not shocking that Hollywood just went, you're dead now? That's fine. We'll make money with your bones.
Yeah.
We don't even need the truth.
That his dead wife is getting near next to zero mentions mm-hmm. in this, knowing what we know now, and just like how that adds so much insult to her legacy and what was done to her, that like in his death, he's getting exalted and his legacy is becoming even more than it was in his, during his life. And she's like been written out of the story completely.
Yeah, it's like, isn't it so sad this poor man's wife was killed? Anyway, let's all talk about how amazing he is. Mm-hmm. Now he's friends with all these celebrities. But yeah, it's would show the value of her life, I think, in his opinion.
And just women versus men in Hollywood.
And like what the audiences were thirsty for at the time, which was like, we want this badass. And this was pre Dirty Harry. Then like Dirty Harry came out and what's his face? Charles. Oh, the guy that Death Wish guy, Charles Bronson. Mm. So like you have these like lawmen who have gone over the edge and you now it's personal. And like that whole genre of movies kind of are born from this person. And then when you go back and look and you're like, oh, the monster that terrorized this area.
Yeah.
But the people that he terrorized were, you know, running backroom dice games. And so some part of the collective unconscious goes, oh, but like he's terrorizing bad people. So yeah. It's fine.
He's like a Robin Hood. Adamsville did its part in securing his legendary legacy. The Buford Pusser Museum opened in his parents' former home in the late 1980s and quickly became the axis for local Pusser tourism. Visitors could walk through reconstructed rooms, view the Corvette wreckage from his fatal crash, and study displays that framed Buford as a one-man army against organized crime. Around town, businesses sold Walking Tall memorabilia, from wooden clubs to novelty t-shirts, and bus tours took visitors to supposed sites of his fights with the state line mob. Roadside signs marked the location of the Dixie Mafia shootout that supposedly killed Pauline.
When you go into the museum, there's just like a 6'6" cutout of him standing on the stairwell. And
all 250 pounds.
And it's his, yeah, just blow it over. But it's, they shrine-like have yeah. reset it to look like when he lived there.
That's weird. It's also always strange to me when people want to see like car crash stuff. And yeah. like, I mean, I don't think he was murdered, but like it kind of falls under that murderabilia, like just tragedy memorabilia stuff.
Yeah. There's a guy
the wrong way.
100%. And you wonder what the impetus is behind it. There mm-hmm. in the show notes, we linked to the local news did a spotlight on a guy in town who has become not associated with the museum, but he has become on his own like a Buford Pusser historian. And he's got all these objects, including the license plate from Buford's burnt up Corvette, and he's like holding it up, and he's like, when this came up for auction, I told my wife, I've got to have it. And he's like, the way he's like holding it in his hands, and of course the news guy's like, oh, okay, very cool. And he's like, this right here, this is a belt buckle that Buford Pusser once wore, and this right here, this is his notepad that he used to write all the people he's gonna go kill without probable cause and due process. But it's like, you can tell this guy has become in one with Buford, and obsessed, and to the point that he purchased a car that is a replica car of what's in Walking Tall. And the guy that's the news guy's like, so do you drive it around? And he's like, not as much as I used to. And I'm like, you just know, everybody's like, that's Dale. He's the crazy pusser guy.
The crazy pusser. It is strange when people get so obsessed with people that they don't even really know, and take it upon themselves to like carry on this legacy.
Yeah. You're going real hard for a person who is dead.
Yeah.
But if you own the museum and you're charging tickets, I think you have a vested financial interest to be like, no, no, the legacy is intact.
Yeah.
Sinister Hood will be right back.
The annual Buford Pusser Festival drew crowds with parades, barbecues, and speeches from local officials who invoked Pusser as the county's protector and patron saint. The city even created community service awards in his name. The myth got another boost in the 2000s with the Dwayne The Rock Johnson remake of Walking Tall, which further distanced the tale from reality. For decades, it seemed the Pusser legacy was untouchable, until the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation decided to reopen Pauline's case in 2023 after receiving a tip. So what do we think?
Well, the Dwayne The Rock Johnson one did distance itself. It changed his name. So you can't have The Rock going around getting called a pusser. So they changed his name to Chris Vaughn.
He said absolutely not when that script came in.
And they did separate it from the South, and they set it in the Pacific Northwest. So
okay, that's quite a difference.
Slightly different. And if I'm not mistaken, in the movie, the wife does not die. They are attacked, but it's not the exact same story. It's just based on the true tale. Yeah. It's like based on the true tale that was based on the true tale. So I think the fact that the movie in 2004 came out, I'm sure the Buford Pusser Festival people are like, learn the real story behind the new Rock movie. And it's just another, you know, get your bag, my friends. Yeah. Like it's another way to do that.
But what do you think they're thinking now?
Well, we're going to talk a lot.
Are they still having these festivals now?
We'll talk in part two, including the community meeting that had to be held after these results were released.
There's a meeting. It's much like the Kris Jenner's 70th birthday party meeting at Jeff Bezos's mansion.
Interesting.
That was all in quotes. Birthday party. Why is all the Illuminati there? You tell me.
Do you mean this Illuminati meeting? Well, speaking of the Illuminati, I do think there was a reach by himself and his family, especially in once he was ineligible to continue to run for sheriff. I think it was kind of like the gravy train's left the station. Like, you're not going to be able to keep doing what you're doing with impunity anymore, which I think it's telling that just as the movie was coming out and just as his career as that specific sheriff, nobody likes change, that the drinking ramped up, the speeding ramped up. You know, he's allegedly at his funeral, there were like all of these celebrities, not just the guy that played him in the movie, but Juana writes how, like, she says that Elvis came to the funeral, and they were known to have known each other, but that Elvis came to the funeral, put his arm around her and said, oh, I'm so sorry, little darling. And maybe that happened. But there's all these kind of legendary stories. And I wonder if, given what we know now, if we're going to start hearing more anecdotes that are on the side of, he came in, he pulled my dad out of his room at 3 a.m. and like put him behind a truck and drug him for three miles. Like, we're going to start to hear, because before, the community was not ready to hear those kind of tales, and perhaps now they might be. I don't know. What do you think?
I think as the years go on and more technology becomes available with law enforcement stuff, that even if you don't want to believe it, I mean, you can still choose not to believe it. There's a lot of people choosing to believe, not believe a lot of shit when stuff's laid right out in front of them. But if you've got like cold, hard evidence that like he did this, like, you know, even for Duana and everyone, it's like, well, am I going to choose to believe what is the truth or continue living the truth that I've accepted and have accepted my whole life? Because I can't bear to admit that this was who this man really was and that I supported him. I think it's parallels a lot to what we're seeing right now with, you know, like if you support someone for a really long time and then you find out they're a horrible fucking person and you either have to decide to eat crow and say I was wrong and, you know, all of Pusser's victims deserve justice. My mother deserves justice, you know? Or you say, I still don't believe it. And you keep living in delusion, but that doesn't mean that the truth is not the truth.
Truly. And it's, I think it gets complicated when there are so many people who have touched that story. Cause it's like, if we determine that this person was, which we'll talk about in part two, you know, but wasn't what we all thought he was, you know, was not the long arm of the law that kept us all safe, but in fact, made us less safe because he engaged with these people. What does it say about George Jones and Tammy Wynette and Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley and like all these people that had connections and was friends with them and stories about them? And one of the oddest stories was Jimmy Buffett had a story about Buford Pusser that he talked about like in concert on live recordings. And of course, it's like a funny anecdote that they Buford Pusser was going to beat the shit out of Jimmy Buffett. They ran into each other at this hotel. Jimmy and his friends were wasted. And he said, we were trying to find our car and we couldn't find it. And I had on these shoes that used to be golf shoes, but they were still kind of like scratchy. And that Jimmy stood up on the hood of a car. And this was like 1970 something. And he like stood up on the hood of a car to try to find his car. And this huge guy came up, who later turns out to be Buford Pusser, and is like, get off my car, I'm going to whoop your ass. And then Jimmy didn't know who he was. It was kind of fucking with him and then runs to his car. And then Buford's like beating his ass through this window and in this gremlin. And because you had to buckle the seat before the engine would start, the Jimmy Buffett couldn't get the car to start. And he said he kept yelling, I don't want to die in a gremlin. So, but he has this, he would tell this story. And then later on, he goes back to the hotel and then some prosecutors, it was a law enforcement conference, Jimmy and Buford run into each other in the lobby again, and some prosecutors drag him to the side and go, get away from that man. I don't know if you know who that is. That's Buford Pusser. And when Jimmy Buffett heard that post Walking Tall, the movie was like, oh, fuck, I'm going to go up to my room. But it was this kind of like funny anecdote that he would tell. So I think the issue becomes like people have woven this into a part of now Jimmy Buffett's, of course, dead and everything. I don't think this is besmirching parrot heads, but it's fascinating. And I think it goes to show why this was not looked at again for so long and how a legend persists is because even when you're already a celebrity, you still want to have a story about how you were close to that weird celebrity. Yeah. You know, it's like a fun story to tell. So
and it becomes interwoven as like this wacky, angry dude, but it's like also mixed in with like levity and a funny story of a gremlin. So like the severity of the situation gets a bit muddied by the comedic interjections, but you're like, when you break it down, you stood on a car and he tried to beat the shit out of you, which is par for the course with how he handled everything. You did something he didn't like, you got shot, you got the shit beat out of you, you got taken to a swamp.
Yeah, he's like, I don't give a fuck if you're a parrot head. I'm a puss head. I'll beat the shit out of you. But I mean, Jimmy Buffett was like, he was beating us so bad, my friend grabbed a pen, like an ink pen, and was like trying to stab him in the arm because it's like Michael Myers. Yeah, he's a psychopath.
Which did nothing. The pen just like explodes. No.
It breaks off because he's just this like formidable person. And by that point, you know, the post shooting scar. So he's got a little, and he's got his hair a little bit longer. And I mean, I don't know that he's ever was like a fluffy kind of guy. I'm like, hey, buddy, why don't you just get off my car? Yeah, just a little bit. So I don't know. I'm excited for us to talk about part two. We're going to dive into the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations, how it got re-involved in so many years later, over 50 years later, and what everybody's different reactions has been and what really happened in 1967. Yeah.
Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can join for free to see what we're up to next or dive into over 1,000 hours of content like Judge Christie, where I rule on petty grievances you bring before the court. True Crime Headlines, where we break down the latest news and updates in true crime. Heather Saves, where anything Heather has found late night scrolling could be discussed. And Am I the Asshole, Unpopular Opinions, and other subreddits that we feel require our input.
We also offer free trials so you can join for a week at any of the tiers, check out all the perks, and cancel anytime before the trial is over without getting charged. And now, through the end of November, you get 20% off an annual membership with code NOVEMBER. When you join, you get months worth of stuff. It's awesome. What all do you get?
You get ad-free episodes, monthly live stream Q&As. We have one coming up this Thursday.
Right.
Quarterly live bonus content that we let you all vote on what kind of content you want us to do. Weekly audio bonus content, mini-sodes, merch discounts, and a community of the best listeners on the whole internet.
Head over to sinisterhood.com and click shop on the top banner to check out merch like t-shirts, mugs, totes, stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos.
They all make great holiday gifts, as does a Patreon subscription.
Hell yeah.
While you're on our website, you can also review the show, submit topics for cases you'd like us to cover, submit your odd but true tales for Freaky Friday, and whatever bizarre or hilarious video you want us to live react to during Sunday Scaries, our weekly live stream over on Patreon every Sunday at 8:30 p.m. Central. It's totally free. You just put in your email, you get immediate access, plus you get a whole backlog of stuff. For free members, you get monthly archived audio content sent to you. There's a ton of video stuff, even old movie roasting things we've done for free members. There's a lot of stuff on there that you can make your way through just for signing up for free. There's also playlists on our website. So when you're sitting around Thanksgiving in the next couple weeks and Grandpa's like, "Do you ever hear about the squawk?" Yeah, Gramps, I got you. And just queue up the cryptid playlist and let it play and see how Turkey Day goes for you.
Hard relate to the squonk on Thanksgiving for
sure. Yeah.
You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Follow us on TikTok and YouTube at Sinisterhood Podcast to watch clips from the episodes, live streams, and more. And if you're looking for a unique and personal gift for the Sinisterhood fan in your life, or maybe you want to treat yourself to a pep talk, book a cameo now. From happy birthday to birth announcements to Merry Christmas, Happy Thanksgiving, Happy New Year, we would love to create a customized video that can be immediately viewed and sent. It's a thoughtful gift. It's perfect when you won't have to go out and shop amongst others. And it's a great way to support us and our small business, you know, amongst others.
It's a great way to support our small business. I shouldn't have stepped on that line.
No worries. Go to cameo.com/sinisterhood. And book now.
Absolutely.
Where are you at on the internet?
I'm on Instagram and Threads at Christy M. Wallace and TikTok at Christy or GTFO. Heather?
I'm on the internet at Heather versus the World.
As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shout-outs. Janelle Stokes.
Desiree Kern.
Amy.
Amber Rose.
Rachel McCleary.
Kate Lester.
Grace.
Kylie Beams.
Megan Trejo.
And Jim Herrera. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We could not do this without you. We hope we pronounced your names correctly. We sincerely appreciate every single one of you. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Sinister. I'm gonna kill you.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.